Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. So, have you ever heard of QAnon, of the mysterious online leader known as Q, of the online information and clues known as Q Drops? QAnon calls itself a movement to save America from corrupt, powerful elites with violence if necessary, and to prepare for some sort of apocalypse. Critics call it a huge, sprawling conspiracy theory, a cult. Among Q's ideas, the pandemic is a hoax, the deep state is the real threat, and Donald Trump is the savior. Millions of people follow Q, including a handful who are now running for Congress. President Trump has retweeted QAnon messages some 90 times in recent months. This hour on Point, we're talking about QAnon. With me from Philadelphia is Adrienne LaFrance. She's executive editor of The Atlantic and has a fascinating story in the current issue entitled The Prophecies of Q. You can link to that at our website, onpointradio.org. Adrienne LaFrance, welcome to On Point. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a fascinating piece, and you begin it by writing that the origins of QAnon are recent, but separating myth from reality can be hard. And you say that one place to begin is with Edgar Madison Welch. And of course, this brings us to Pizzagate, but let's start there. Tell us about Edgar Madison Welch and his connection to Q.
So the reason I started this story with Pizzagate was that it's important to recognize that QAnon, although very recent, borrows from a lot of earlier conspiracy theories, as well as just conspiracy type thinking that goes way, way back, arguably to antiquity. And so with Pizzagate, this is the idea that emerged after the WikiLeaks dump during the last presidential election that suggested that a child sex abuse ring was based in a Washington, D.C. pizza shop. And so this was a rumor that was all over the internet. People were making YouTube videos about it, tweeting about it, all over the social web. And Edgar Madison Welch is a young man who started watching these YouTube videos and really believed in it. And finally, in December of 2016, he took matters into his own hands, drove from his home in North Carolina to Washington, D.C., to this pizza shop, Comet Ping Pong, and walked into the pizza shop with two loaded weapons looking for evidence of this child sex ring. Of course, he didn't find it, and thankfully, no one was hurt. He did fire one of his weapons into a door that was ultimately just a computer storage closet. And when he realized that he wasn't finding the thing he expected, he put down his weapons and surrendered to the police. So the reason I started there is it shows sort of one of the foundational lies that inspired the QAnon conspiracy theory, but it also demonstrates that this isn't just something that's going on online, and it's not just a game, and it's certainly not harmless.
Right. And I love one of the quotes you have from this man who went into that pizza shop when he didn't find evidence of the child sex ring. He said the intel on this wasn't 100%. But does he back away from this central idea underlying the Pizzagate message that a cabal of powerful elites was abusing children and getting away with it?
Well, it seems, I mean, certainly from that quote that he wasn't backing away, that it wasn't a realization that, oh my goodness, I've been duped, but rather I didn't find the right spot and people should keep looking. And he later went to federal prison, and I haven't talked to him, so I don't know if he's, you know, reflected further upon the incident or his beliefs since then. But right after the incident, he certainly didn't seem to back away.
Right. So QAnon, you write, derives from a mysterious figure, Q, who was posting anonymously on 4chan. Can you describe QAnon's belief system, which you do so well in the article? Give us a sense of what we're talking about here. What is the belief system?
So I think you teed us up pretty well here. It's this idea that Q, this mysterious figure, is an intelligence or military insider with proof that corrupt, high-profile world leaders, especially Democrats, business leaders, even Hollywood celebrities, are all secretly torturing children, and that they're embedded within the deep state. The quote-unquote deep state is enabling this abuse. And that ultimately Donald Trump is the one who's going to bring these crimes to light and stop them.
Right.
And so where Q fits into this is this figure Q is posting repeatedly, sometimes multiple times per day, these what the Q community refer to as Q drops. So these are just online posts, but people call them Q drops, and they're clues or sort of things for the followers of QAnon to decipher to further in their belief in this theory, but also to give participants a sense that they're fighting back. So through their interpretation, they're participating in fighting back against their belief of this deep state enabled ring.
Right. And you write, among other things, so there's no physical location, but Q has an infrastructure, a literature, a growing body of adherents, and a great deal of merchandising. So I want to unpack some of that, starting with Q's adherents. Who are they? What do we know about them? And maybe the place to start there is, do we have any idea of how many we're talking about?
I don't know how many, and this was one of the really difficult things to try to figure out in the course of my reporting. And it's difficult because it's such a geographically disaggregate movement, and because it plays out across so many different sites online. But you can get a sense that it's growing. So you see that there are the people who are making YouTube videos for audiences that are interested in Q, the followings of those channels keep swelling. Same thing for these major Facebook groups where Q followers congregate. And so where you'll find them offline is a little trickier because it's so based on the internet. Where I looked for believers was at Trump rallies. And so I think one of the big questions I had was who would believe this stuff in the first place? When I talked to people in person, I was actually fairly surprised that the experience was different from what you see maybe on Twitter. So on Twitter, you'll see Q followers kind of swarm in someone's replies, and it's rather aggressive and sometimes hostile. What I found when I was talking to individuals was a real sense of serenity that I didn't expect. People who just are deriving a great amount of hope from their belief in QAnon. And they may also air frustrations about the establishment. It's a very anti-establishment conspiracy theory. But there wasn't that same kind of hostility that's frequently associated with QAnon. That doesn't mean that it's ultimately not a dangerous movement. I believe it is. But the individuals who are drawn to it, and you know, the vast majority of them are not going to carry out any sort of violent attack, were really, you know, deriving a sense of peace and hope from QAnon that really surprised me.
I want to continue with some of these followers or adherents that you met. You spent some time, I believe it was at a Trump rally in Toledo, Ohio, and you met someone named Lori Schock, who told you that we're not a terror group. She spends up to 6 hours a day reading and rereading these Q drops. Do I have this right? She believes Q is actually President Trump.
I asked her who she thought Q was, and that is what she told me. I think she also sort of doesn't care who Q is, which was also something that surprised me. I went into my reporting the story, A, hoping that I could find out the identity of Q, which I ultimately did not, and B, wanting to know, you know, my assumption was that people who follow this conspiracy theory found Q to be credible. And so I wanted to know who they thought it was. But it turned out that they didn't really think about it in those terms of credibility. And the thing I heard again and again from Lori and from others was, this is so much bigger than Q, the person or the people behind the account, whoever this person or people are. And that I even asked one gentleman, like, what would you do if you found out tomorrow that it's all a hoax? The person who's been acting as Q admits it. how would you react? And again, he said it didn't matter. The movement is so much bigger than Q at this point. And that was something else that I didn't anticipate going in.
Right. And just sticking with Laurie Schock for a moment, she said, God led me to Q. And I'm wondering how common is that? Because you also talk about how Q, the movement, sort of uses the language of evangelical Christianity, right?
Right. It was really common in terms of the people I talked to. And this is what sort of ended up driving the way I thought about this story, was that there was this really palpable spiritual element. And Laurie in particular was reluctant to talk about this at first. But when I asked her directly, she did say it was directly a connection to her belief in God. And others said the same, that this was a spiritual, their involvement in Q was fulfilling a spiritual need. Another one of the most well-known sort of Q influencers, someone who YouTubes by the handle of Praying Medic, he's someone who is writing books about Christianity, self-published books about Christianity, and considers Q almost a form of church, the way he talks about it. And so there is this really clear religious thread running through every conversation I had with the people who really believe in it.
And I want to ask you as well about what we need to understand about the threat here, about the potential danger. I learned from your article that last year the FBI classified QAnon as a domestic terror threat. And there's an FBI memo that noted that a California man arrested in 2018 had bomb-making materials, was a follower of Q. So what more do we know about sort of the danger that this movement represents?
So there is a real danger. I mean, we're talking about a movement that is fiercely anti-establishment, which means fiercely anti-free press, just really uses the language of militarization. And, you know, I mentioned the folks who derive a sense of peace and sort of serenity from the movement. But if you look at the rhetoric of the Q drops, and you know, it borrows from all of the most heated rhetoric that you hear from President Trump. And that has inspired real world violence, which we've seen.
Well, we're going to talk more about that, specifically this connection to President Trump, after the break. We're talking about a sprawling conspiracy theory called QAnon and its followers, what they believe. I'm joined by Adrienne LaFrance. She's executive editor of The Atlantic magazine. You can find a link to her piece at onpointradio.org. More from Adrienne after we return. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking this hour about a sprawling online movement called QAnon and how it's gathering a surprising number of followers, including a number of people running for Congress. My guest is Adrienne LaFrance, executive director of The Atlantic. Her recent story in the magazine is entitled The Prophecies of Q, and we have a link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. And if you have comments or questions about Q, you can post them on Twitter or Facebook at onpointradio. Adrienne, I wanted to ask you about the connection to President Trump, because it's interesting you note that Q takes a page from Trump's playbook, frequently railing against legitimate sources of information as fake. What do we know? What do we know about the connection to President Trump? I mean, is President Trump an adherent? Is there evidence of that?
Well, we know the conspiracy theory itself is fundamentally pro-Trump. So you'll often hear people describe QAnon as a far-right conspiracy, and that's not actually right. What it is a pro-Trump conspiracy and a conspiracy theory. And so the connection, you know, it's all built upon this idea that Trump is the savior figure that will carry the nation to this post. You know, they talk about the storm, the coming storm, which is meant to represent the arrests of all of these people allegedly participating in a secret cabal. And Trump is said to be the one who will expose them and take the nation back to where it ought to be. And so really, it's fundamentally concerned with Trump. As far as his participation or awareness of it, I mean, this is sort of the classic President Trump thing where he sort of dances right up to the edge of plausible deniability and winks and nods at the movement through retweets and even arguably through some of the language he uses in press conferences, or at least certainly people seize upon when he makes references to the storm. And yet he never explicitly talks about it. And so he's able to sort of say, I have no idea what the thing is, and yet clearly nod to the crowd who is so interested in his validation of the conspiracy theory.
You just made reference to the storm. This is because Q talks about the calm before the storm. We're in the calm before the storm, right?
That's right. And that was sort of one of these many, many in-group phrases that the Q crowd uses.
Right. Now, speaking of President Trump, of course, he's one of the biggest conspiracy theorists out there. When he was running for president, he claimed that Barack Obama was an American born. So in a sense, this whole conspiracy theory promoted by Q is consistent with the kind of conspiracy that the president has put in play going way back.
Exactly. He's built his entire political career on conspiracy theories. And so it makes sense that a portion of his base would be participating in this one and that it would be so concerned with Trump as a central figure.
Right. A lot of what Q predicts, pretty much everything that Q predicts looks like pure fabrication. And then ultimately, it's proven wrong. For example, you write that in October 2018, Q wrote that Hillary Rodham Clinton is being extradited, detained, and there are suggestions that she will soon be arrested. Of course, that was nonsense. It never happens. How do followers respond to that when you point out to them, look, the stuff is wrong. It's nonsense. It doesn't measure up to reality.
This is one of the more mind-melting aspects of talking to people who believe in QAnon, is they are not interested in empiricism. And so if you raise the fact that, you know, Hillary Clinton was never arrested, what do you make of that? There is always an explanation. It's always either, well, it hasn't happened yet, is one common response, or you're just misreading the way that Q wrote it. And in fact, there's some additional clue layered in this thing and you shouldn't be taking it literally. That's another common refrain. And just time and time again, I mean, it's really remarkable that you're talking about a crowd of people devoted to Q because they say they're so interested in seeking truth and thinking for themselves. And yet they reject truth and ignore any facts that might lead the way to truth. And so there's this real disconnect in how they talk about the predictions that haven't come true.
And speaking of Hillary Clinton, you spoke to Hillary Clinton about Q or QAnon. What did she tell you about the nature of the threat, how she responded to it?
Well, there were two memorable things there. One was just that she said she really didn't appreciate how bad the situation was while she was running for president. She didn't really grasp the scale of the disinformation until after the election was over. And she's afraid. I mean, she's very thankful that she still has security protecting her and sorting through her mail before it gets to her, for example. But she finds it profoundly scary. And you know, we've seen in other countries how people, when there's a break with reality and someone sets their, and in our own country, when someone, you know, decides to take matters into their own hands violently based on bad misinformation, people get hurt. And so, you know, she's frightened by it.
Adrian LaFrance, stand by, because I want to introduce Joseph Uzinski, who you quote in your article. He joins us from Miami. He's a professor of political science at the University of Miami, and he's co-author with Joseph Parent of the book American Conspiracy Theories. He's editor of editor of Conspiracy Theories and the People Who Believe Them. And he co-authored a column in yesterday's Washington Post, which we've linked to at onpointradio.org. And Joseph Uzinski, welcome to On Point. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So you've been listening along. I'd love to get your take on what Q is. I mean, I think as I've read some of your writing, your idea is it's not necessarily linked to the political left or the political right. Is that right?
So we've been polling on it for the last 2 years. And even though it's almost always referred to as an extreme right or far right conspiracy theory, there's nothing extreme or far right about it. There's really no connection between conservatism or republicanism as we know it to this conspiracy theory, because it's not as if somebody would go down the rabbit hole of liking George W. Bush and then getting into Ronald Reagan and then reading Milton Friedman, and then all of a sudden it's satanic baby eaters. It just doesn't work like that. So these folks who are following Q aren't doing it because they're chasing an extreme form of William F. Buckley conservatism. They are off the beaten path of regular left-right politics.
But what about the adherence to President Trump? Because that would seem to suggest a kind of rightward tilt to the political ideology. Or am I reading that wrong, incorrectly?
Trump has ran under the Republican label, and he has some Republican-ish, conservative-ish issues. But I would not call Trump a normal Republican or a normal conservative in any way we think of those intellectual traditions. So that is reflected in QAnon, is that these people who support the group and the movement come from both sides of the political aisle, and it's not really about lowering the budget or anything like that. This is about taking out vengeance on political and social enemies and sending them to the gallows for their supposed crimes against humanity.
Hmm. How dangerous is it, in your view?
Well, the good news is that very few people have taken action based on this. But what concerns me is that the beliefs themselves are almost an incitement to violence. I mean, if you said that your political enemies were eating children and molesting them, and, you know, sucking magical powers out of their glands for some weird satanic black magic. I mean, there's nothing worse you could say about a group of people. I mean, that in itself is an incitement to violence.
Right. Adrian, I want to bring you back in. Does that first of all, comment, if you would, about Joseph's idea about Q not adhering to sort of one side or the other of the political spectrum. Does that sound right to you?
Absolutely. And Joseph and I have talked about conspiracy theories for years, and he's been thinking really deeply about this. I mean, he's of course right that it isn't fundamentally a right-wing thing, because Trump isn't a normal right-wing politician. And so it really, Trump as the central figure is the key here. And in terms of the danger it poses, I mean, I think in addition to incitement to violence, we also have to think about what it means for a society to experience this mass rejection of reason and enlightenment values. You know, that carries its own dangers that further incite violence, but are also just really harmful to a democracy. And so it's a layer upon layer of danger, I think.
I wanted, speaking of layer upon layer of danger, I think you wrote about this, Adrian. I've got it in my notes, so I think this came from your article. Forgive me for being a little vague here, but I think you wrote that the mass shooting in El Paso, Texas, at the Walmart, where 22 people were killed, there was evidence that the shooter was linked or abetted by Q. Do I have that right?
The connection I made there was less about Q, but more the platform where Q exists. And so this is the Chans, or the image message boards. Q started on 4chan, then moved to 8chan, which has now become a site called 8kun. And this is where you've also seen these manifestos from multiple mass shootings. So it's more a comment on the kind of disinformation and violent viewpoints that are supported by these Chan boards.
Hmm. And can you explain how these Chan boards work for folks who might not be familiar with them? I have to confess that I've just been reading about them recently. Explain how they work and how Q has used them and migrated, I understand, from one to another.
Sure. So these are image message boards. And if you're familiar with, like, Pepe the Frog, who became sort of a cartoon hero among the Trump set in 2016. This is where a lot of, like, grotesque memes are shared. And, you know, there's really, really terrible content shared on these Chans. And the folks who spend a lot of time there really relish kind of being the one of the darker corners of the internet. And so it's hard to navigate as well. It's interesting. It's one of the last really anonymous places online. So whereas before the founding of Facebook and, you know, before the web sort of went from being this open system to more walled gardens with the big social media platforms, you had all kinds of places where people could just share things anonymously, and that was sort of the norm. And 4chan, which was ultimately replaced by 8chan, and now, like, this is just, the site has changed ownership and evolved. This is really one of the last holdouts where people can stay anonymous and post really terrible things without people knowing necessarily who they are. And the Anon in QAnon refers to this anonymity. It's sort of one of the ways that people on these boards describe themselves is as Anon.
Joseph, of course, conspiracy theories. I mean, we're talking about this as if it's news here and Q is sort of a relatively new phenomenon. But the idea of conspiracy theories defining American life have gone on for a long, long time. Can you sort of place this in the history of these big conspiracy theories that have dominated?
So as wacky as the QAnon conspiracy theories sound, there's nothing new to them. And in fact, it's just a whole bunch of other longstanding conspiracy theories all mushed together into one. I mean, if you just take the basic idea of QAnon, which is that there is a pedophile deep state working against the president, well, that's certainly not new. That's the plot of Oliver Stone's movie JFK, which came out 30 years ago. So there isn't particularly anything new or creative here. And having studied conspiracy theories for almost a decade, I guess I'm more bored now than ever because they're not particularly creative people. It's the same stuff over and over again. Mm. And even with coronavirus conspiracy theories, it's the same theories, just different nouns. Over and over again. So as we're accusing Bill Gates of doing something bad, well, last year it was George Soros. And then a few decades before that, it was the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and whatever rich family is in the news at any given time will accuse them of something. So there's nothing new or exciting. It's just the people with these very strong conspiratorial worldviews are just pointing their ire at some new thing. And what Q has done is to galvanize these people around a set of ideas and just direct it and weaponize it in a way that we haven't normally seen in conspiracy theory before, because what Q really is isn't so much about conspiracy theory. I mean, that's the set of beliefs, but what it really is a cult. They have a sense of group belonging. And even though they're decentralized because they're online, they have their own catchphrases, their own sense of destiny. They lean on each other. And this is what makes them more dangerous than other things. I mean, if you and I both believed that there was a conspiracy behind, you know, the assassination of President Kennedy, well, it doesn't make us friends. I wouldn't feel a special kinship to you. But for QAnons, there's something special there. They feel like they're part of a community. And that's what makes this all the more dangerous.
Right. And of course, you know, you mentioned JFK. There's been conspiracies that the moon landing never happened, that 9/11 was caused by other forces, on and on. I guess what's different when you talk about weaponizing this conspiracy theory, it has a lot to do with the power of the internet that has sort of added rocket fuel to the potentially dangerous effect of this particular conspiracy theory. Is that fair to say?
No.
Oh, okay, good.
I personally wouldn't say that at all. And it's absolutely true that Q exists online, but we've had cults like this exist long before the internet. Huh. So that's certainly nothing new.
No, but I mean, doesn't the internet give them power, I guess, and sort of add more threat to the potential danger?
Perhaps. But here's the thing, is that we're not seeing an increase in conspiracy beliefs writ large since the introduction of the internet. As crazy as it seems, given everything we read about conspiracy theories, in the polling I've done over the last decade, I'm not seeing an increase in the disposition to believe conspiracy theories. And many conspiracy theories, the beliefs in them are actually going down. I mean, just to give you one example, I mean, it only took a few months for 50% of Americans to think that Kennedy was killed by a conspiracy. Hmm. That was long before the internet or social media. By the mid-70s, it was up to 80%. That's the highest, most believed conspiracy theory that I've seen in the polling era.
Interesting.
And we have not seen that matched during the internet era.
Joseph, sorry to step on you. We're coming up on a break. Adrian LaFrance, Joseph Uzinski, stand by. We're going to talk more about QAnon, this online conspiracy, what it means, where it's going. And after the break, how it's affecting how millions of people might be thinking about the pandemic. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. My guests today are Joseph Uzinski, a professor of political science at the University of Miami and an expert in conspiracy theories and why people are drawn to them. Also with us, Adrian LaFrance, executive editor of The Atlantic, who published a fascinating and disturbing story about the cult called QAnon. And Adrian, I wanted to come to you about a really interesting point that you make in this article. Q may be anonymous, you say, but leaders of QAnon have sort of emerged in public and built their own large audience. So can you talk a little bit about how the sort of myth and the kind of power of Q is spread by other people who aren't necessarily Q, we don't think?
Right. So this goes actually to the question you asked before the break about the extent to which this is internet-enabled. And I think it's really interesting because Joseph may be right that people today are no more likely to be prone to conspiracism than they were, you know, in the 20th century or even like going back to the Crusades, for that matter. We have evidence of conspiracy thinking in antiquity. But the thing is, the internet has enabled for people who are prone to those worldviews to find their people, so to speak. And so I don't think that we can discount the power of the social web in spreading these things. I mean, it's clear we have the evidence that this is how they spread and how they go from being something that might be sort of niche or a regionally specific cult to a global movement. And so in terms of some of the figures who are helping prompt that along, you see folks who are developing massive YouTube audiences or Facebook groups, Twitter following, just really leveraging social media as sort of the experts on QAnon and the expert interpreters. It's a really complicated conspiracy theory with like infinite sort of recursive sub-theories within it. And so a lot of the people who are kind of dabbling look to these figures as those who can help them sort of parse through the different clues and find meaning.
And what do we know about the parts of the mainstream Republican Party that have latched on? I think I read in your piece, 11 QAnon supporters are now 2020 Republican congressional nominees. Is that right?
Well, it's actually much higher now. And I know Media Matters is keeping a tally. I don't have the latest numbers in front of me, but I believe it was something closer to 60, at least people running for Congress. And in some cases, those were candidates who won their primaries. And so my sense is that, you know, again, this is a pro-Trump conspiracy theory, which follows a lot of the sort of basic rhetoric that Trump's base most responds to. And other politicians see that and see how effective it's been for him and have either seized on it as a way of running a political campaign or at least not felt the need to hide their own beliefs as part of running for office.
Yeah. Joseph Uzinski, how troubling is that? That parts of the mainstream Republican Party seem to be latching on to this?
Well, I don't know if it's parts of the mainstream Republican Party. I mean, there are people associated with the group who are running. Some of them have gotten nominations. We will see in November how many of them actually win. We have to draw a distinction, though. I mean, there are some of the candidates are truly, you know, real believers in it. They've taken the online digital soldier oath, and they use the catchphrases frequently, and they talk about their sincere beliefs in it. But for other ones, they've just used it as a campaign tool. And if you think about it, that makes a little bit of sense. I mean, during the summer, during a pandemic, when you're going to have primary voting for congressional seats that most people don't really care about, don't know about, and you're going to have a very small number of people voting, reaching out to this group may not be such a bad idea, strategically speaking, because if you could pull a few of them into your camp in a primary, that can actually, you know, may very well help you. But what we found is that some of the people who have spoken the Q language on the campaign trail don't necessarily have, you know, sincere beliefs, or they have backed away from it once they got the nomination. And I think incentives, should they win, will lead them to stay as far away from it as possible.
I want to talk a little bit more about the really dangerous misinformation and disinformation out there around COVID-19 and the pandemic. And I want to introduce Jane Litvinenko. She joins us from Toronto. She's a senior reporter for BuzzFeed News and has been reporting on disinformation for the past 4 years. Jane, welcome. It's good to have you. Thank you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, sort of sum up what we're seeing out there around disinformation around COVID-19 and the pandemic, and then I want to bring it back to Q because I know this is also a factor there. But what are you seeing out there?
Well, disinformation about the pandemic really started as soon as word of the pandemic got out. So we've been dealing with it for months. And while early on it was really sort of confusion about what was happening in China and then in Europe before it came over to the US, and a lot of opportunists sort of trying to make a quick buck off of it, now a lot of the themes that we saw either early on or as the lockdown started, they've really become entrenched. So sort of one of the earlier stages of disinformation surrounding a topic is kind of throwing all narratives that you can at a wall and seeing what sticks. And now we're seeing what stuck. And a lot of what stuck is fairly dangerous health mis and disinformation.
Such as?
And So we're looking at, of course, use of masks has been a big point of contention, not just in the U.S., but worldwide, but also how deadly the pandemic is and how much we know of the science behind it. There was a lot of confusion early on about what we're looking at, but as more science is coming out, that early confusion has really cemented mistrust about what we should be thinking, believing now.
Right. And what about the sort of number of sources? I mean, what are the sort of worst offenders of spreading this kind of disinformation?
So we're seeing a few different ways that this false information spreads. One is through private networks that we don't really have a lot of access to, so we don't really have a full picture of. These are things like group chats, Instagram stories, those sort of temporary mediums that are not public. But the other side of it is that we're seeing a lot of it spread from video platforms to social media platforms. And the most common pipeline that we see is a video that's either posted to YouTube or another video service that then spreads across Facebook groups and then finds its way to the mainstream. It's tricky to say why this particular flow of information sticks with people, but we do know that it has an effect and that it is incredibly popular. We've seen that information pipeline weaponized a few times during the pandemic now.
So, Adrian, let me come back to you and bring it back to QAnon, because I understand that among the things that circulate through the QAnon community is that the coronavirus might not be real. So what does Q and its adherents believe about the pandemic?
Well, Q has been sort of, as usual, cryptic throughout. I mean, it's mostly just the Q drops have really taken cues from how Trump has talked about coronavirus, and so they track really closely. The interesting thing I'll mention, though, just building off of what Jane was saying, is, you know, these aren't just conspiracies about the pandemic that are spreading through fringe channels or even just on Facebook. We saw recently that Sinclair, which runs lots of local news channels, came very close to airing, material associated with one of the bigger conspiracy theory videos that people know as Plandemic. And so the troubling thing is it's not just in Q drops, though it's also there, but it really has crept into people's mainstream media diet, which is terrifying.
Very terrifying, yeah. And Joseph, I want to ask you the same question. I mean, how do you see conspiracy theories contributing to this epidemic, I guess, of misinformation about the pandemic?
Well, if people have beliefs that are not tethered to our shared reality, then their behaviors that spring from those beliefs are going to be potentially deleterious. I mean, I think it's important to understand that, you know, we tend to focus on the Plandemic video or things going on social media, but some of the biggest spreaders are the same old things that have always driven public opinion in this country, and that's the mainstream legacy media and political elites. And when this started, President Trump came out and said that the coronavirus was the Democrats' conservative media thought leaders, said that Dr. Fauci was maybe not even a real doctor and perhaps part of the deep state. Fox News personalities have suggested going to film the hospitals because the hospitals don't really have any coming from.
Sorry, Joseph, we lost you for about 20 seconds there. Back up a little bit and just restart that thought. Sorry about that.
So a lot of this is really coming from mainstream news sources, whether it's Fox News or conservative news radio or from the president and other like-minded political elites, is that much of the influence here isn't coming from Plandemic videos or online stuff. I mean, people can go online and they can, you know, select what they want. And generally what we find is that people who are conspiracy believers are going to go and get stuff that tells them what they already believe. But the real movers of public opinion can be these, the Rush Limbaughs and the Donald Trumps of the world. And we have to pay particular attention to them.
Mm. So
I think that's a really important point. I'll just say in the context of QAnon, they really are following Trump's lead. So the Q movement is echoing Trump.
Interesting. Interesting. And Adrian, the fact that, and we mentioned this earlier in the hour, that the FBI has classified QAnon as a domestic terror threat, what does that mean in real terms, in terms of what the government, and I know it gets confusing when we talk about the government, because are we talking about the Trump White House, are we talking about the Justice Department, but I guess in this case, the Justice Department, what is the Justice Department actually doing about this, or what does that tell you how seriously they're taking it?
Well, and I should say this isn't just QAnon. It's conspiracy theories generally that this FBI memo detailed as being a potential danger to look out for in terms of just the spread of extremism broadly. And I think what they're doing about it is the way that they would handle trying to sort of stop extremism of all kinds. The larger question to me is less about law enforcement, although of course it matters what they're doing, but really about the people who can control the spread of this on the platforms. And so a big question is, you know, for the Facebooks of the world, for Facebook specifically, but also Google and even Amazon, how they're thinking about what responsibility they have to stop the spread of dangerous misinformation on their platform.
Right. What do you think about that, Joseph Uzinski? And then I want to come to you as well, our reporter in Toronto. But Joseph, let me start with you.
So all of this Q stuff is ubiquitous online if you want to find it. But I mean, just to put it in perspective, a poll came out a couple months ago that showed that 75% of Americans didn't know what it was. In my own polls, it comes out very unpopular, and it's one of the least popular things we poll about. And even polls outside of the ones that I do show that about 6% of Americans believe in the QAnon conspiracy theory, and that's one of the least believed conspiracy theories that I poll on. So as much as you can find it online, it doesn't seem to be growing at all in the 2 years I've been polling on it, and it doesn't really seem to be getting bigger, regardless of the fact that it's easy to get a hold of if you look for it.
Interesting. And Jane, to you on this issue of the platforms, the Facebooks, Googles, Amazons, whatever we're talking about, in terms of spreading misinformation specifically about the pandemic, are the platforms taking this seriously in your view?
So I think one of the things that we should look at to answer that question is the sort of long view. Platforms have been aware that mis and disinformation on their platforms, hate speech on their platforms, they've been aware of this since the election a few years ago, but even earlier if you think about all the activists outside of the U.S. who've warned them about this problem. And they have taken steps over the last few years to try to address this. But the trouble is that just as Twitter recently announced that it's going to narrow the presence of QAnon on its platform based on coordinated harassment that supporters sometimes engage in, it might be a little bit too late, because a lot of these communities, QAnon is one, but it's important to point out that it's not the only one, and that a lot of people believe in falsehoods but don't consider themselves conspiracy theorists or don't believe in QAnon. The platforms essentially through inaction have created existing audiences that are sometimes pretty engaged in what they believe in or in the personalities that they follow online. And so the fact that videos like Plandemic can spread quickly is a result of those communities sort of existing on the platform already. But I think that Joseph's point is really important, which is that the falsehoods are very often legitimized by real personalities, real commentators who pick up on them. And whether it's for political gain or to play to their base, really bring legitimacy to things that we see online.
Adrian, we're running out of time, but in the sort of 10 or 15 seconds that are left, after writing this fabulous piece about QAnon, what's still left outstanding? What's the big question that you want the answer to?
Well, I want to know who Q is, obviously. That's a question I still have. I also want to know, I mean, my sense is the social platforms do have a lot more work to do. This sort of whack-a-mole approach is better than nothing, but we need to take seriously how the internet works and is built if we want to fix this problem.
All right. Adrienne LaFrance, executive editor of The Atlantic, thank you so much for your piece, and thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And Joseph Uzinski, he's a professor of political science at the University of Miami. Thank you, Joseph. It was great having you.
Thank you.
And Jane Litvenko of BuzzFeed News from Toronto. Thanks so much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.